So it's possible that the story that Buddhism tells begins with desire. One place where it begins is in the story that's told that in order to be reborn when someone dies, that there has to be some desire for the next life, a kind of craving, a kind of reaching forward, grabbing on to the next moment of consciousness in a new life. And without that desire, or the word is actually craving, then there would be no birth. And I wonder what consciousness is craving at that time. Maybe it's just craving. Whether this is actually true or part of the myth, I don't know. But it's a nice story. If we see it as a mirror of our minds, sometimes our minds are driven by desire. Sometimes it's incessant desire, just goes on and on. And if we really kind of look carefully at what our mind's up to, what we're thinking about, I suspect that not too far away, maybe underneath it all, there's some desire for life, for pleasure, for security, safety, for success, for status, for relationships. So a lot of things that we're trying to get, trying to figure out, trying to do with our lives. And some of these things are completely appropriate and I would say even necessary. Nothing wrong in and of themselves. But one of the problems is when it's incessant, when it's continuous. It's like, you know, if someone might be hungry and so they would like breakfast at breakfast time and lunch at lunch time and dinner at dinner time, and that's fine. And so they have their meal and they have their fill. And as soon as they've finished eating, all they think about is wanting more food. All day long, wanting food. And, you know, it's other things to think about in this life of ours. It's a little bit, you know, limiting to only think about that all the time. And so it's, if we're driven by desire, by wanting all the time, just churning away, it is limiting for us. And so the Buddhist journey is to begin realizing how much we're driven by desire for craving, for thirst, and kind of a certain compulsion, and to learn that we can take a vacation, to learn that it's possible to pause the continuous desiring, wanting that goes on for another opportunity, another possibility. And that possibility, Buddhism uses rather grand names for awakening, enlightenment, enlightened pauses, enlightened vacations. But, you know, it's a pretty wonderful to pause or to stop the desires, because generally it's the churning of desire that keeps the mind agitated, that keeps the mind contracted, it keeps the mind hungry, keeps the mind suffering. And so when the incessant desire stops, then there's a much better chance for the mind to settle and to be peaceful. So much so that some people who experience this kind of peace kind of come to the conclusion that it's the nature of the mind to be peaceful in and of itself, if it's just left alone of desire. So, you know, we're trying to come to terms with desire, understand it and see it. And it can operate quite powerfully. It can operate in such a habit of desire that sometimes, for some people, I think I've seen it in me, I have desire before I know what I desire. And then I fill it in. With something, but it's just the principle I should want something. And I saw this very strong when my son was quite young enough that I was holding him in my arms, and He was very content and happy being held by his father. And maybe I made the mistake of taking him into Safeway. And so we were walking down the aisles, and there was he started wanting things that he saw. And he was wanting that and that and that, you know. And I couldn't give him everything he wanted, so it was rather distressing for him and for me. But at some point I saw him, he didn't have any idea what was behind his back, what was behind him. And he just kind of took his hand, his arm, and he turned and reached like that he wanted. There wasn't anything that he, you know, it wasn't a thing that was the focus of his desire, it was the wanting. Or maybe there was a thing that he wanted that I didn't know what it was. Maybe it was something, some deeper yearning for something that I didn't know, but he was searching for or wanting. But this idea of just functioning of desire, keeping us agitated, keeping us preoccupied. For me, in times when I've been caught up in desire, I feel very much that I'm up in my head. I call it the control tower. And it's very dissatisfying to be up there because it feels somewhat disconnected to all of who I am, the fullness of my being. I feel much more at home in this world when I'm at home in my body, settled in my body. So seemingly that who I am, how I manifest in the world, seems to arise out of the body, out of the desires and thoughts that are spinning around in the head. So as many of you know, in Buddhism, the idea is that a certain kind of desire is the source, the condition for suffering. And so the task is to begin understanding that kinds of desire and to settle it, to quiet it, to become free of a certain kind of desire. And certainly free of the compulsivity that can be around desires. And the tradition teaches mindfulness for this purpose, teaches looking carefully at what's happening, observing, being present for it. And there's two things that happen with the observation. One is that we learn to see what's there. Start recognizing aspects of our inner life that are often not seen in ordinary life. People are not trained to look at parts of their functioning. So we're not seeing how our thoughts, our beliefs, our emotions, our desires function for us. The other is we learn also how to see. We learn how do we look? To be able to be present for experience, the how, with in a way that's not itself caught in expectations, greed, aversion, hostility. The how that's open, relaxed, committed, engaged, present, but without contraction, without desperation, without a lot of self and ego, egotistical ideas and identity ideas, or trying to prove ourselves, or learning how to just see in a very simple way. But simple doesn't mean simple and powerful, I think. Use that as an expression. And these two go together, that how we see and what we see support each other. As we can see in a simpler, more open, more relaxed way, without straining, without trying, without fixing, without pushing things away, then it's kind of like we start seeing with clearer and clearer glasses or clearer eyes. We see greater clarity of what's there. And the task, the goal is to be able to see clearly. And in a sense, that's what vipassana means, to see clearly. And there's three things that the tradition holds up that are really helpful to see clearly if what you want to do is to not be caught in the grips of desires or grips of these compulsivities that keep us churning and spinning and wanting. And this is to be able to see in a particular way the inconstancy of our experience, often said called the impermanence, to see the unsatisfactoriness of our experience, sometimes called the suffering that comes along, and to see the impersonality of it all, or to see how this not-self of the experience. These are called the three characteristics, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And it's kind of the, when I went to Thailand, Burma, and practiced there, I was kind of in awe at how often the teachers there talked about these three things over and over and over again. And I certainly had my debates with them and questioned how they were teaching it. And I had to kind of contend with all kinds of ideas around these three characteristics and their value and their importance. And that kind of struggling with it continued until, for me to some degree, until my mind was in fact settled and calm and focused enough where these things came to me like revelation. I started to see them in a way that I could have imagined when I was thinking about these things and thinking how they work. But it was kind of like, you can never imagine what it's like to be in a forest until you go into it, and then you can, for the first time, you see it, what it's like. So you go into the world of inconstancy, of change. It's not just a thought. But this emphasis that teachers often will emphasize these three characteristics over and over again, I think does a little disservice for people. And sometimes it's used very unskillfully. I remember there have been times, a few times now in my life, where some people have come to me in my role as a teacher, and someone else third party was struggling about something, and they said, you should go talk to them and tell them everything's impermanent and they should get over it, relax. So I did not do that. And at least one of those times, it was a political move. It was things were being changed in the organization in ways that I thought were unskillful. And the people who were the victims of the unskillfulness were protesting and were hurt. And then the people who instituted the unskillful things came and said, you should go tell them, that everything changes. Now I'm going to use Buddhist teachings to justify injustice. That didn't seem right to me. And also sometimes when it's overemphasized, these three characteristics taught over and over again, they're true in a particular context, certain kind of way, but to universalize them too quickly and too much does a disservice to people, to some people. So, for example, there are people whose lives are phenomenally unstable. They grew up in war zones and, constantly on the move. For some reason, maybe because I was thinking of this today, I counted how many times I changed schools from kindergarten to 12th grade. I changed school 12 times. That's a lot of change. And I don't know if I exactly suffered from it, but I'm sure it had an influence on me. And so there's people who have radical change and much more difficult than what I ever experienced. And to tell them everything's changing just kind of makes them feel like there's no hope then. There's no stability anywhere, there's not a support. There are people who have tremendous suffering. And to hear the Buddha say everything is suffering, you might as well give up. And there are people for whom their sense of self have never been developed or have been crushed or, has been somehow deeply wounded and by how society treats them, and to then come and say that they're, you know, some people just love to say that the Buddha taught there is no self, and so then that's kind of confusing. And or some people who have very kind of poorly formed sense of self find a relief in Buddhism. Finally, I'm in the place where I belong. But it's not really that healthy to kind of not have a strong kind of, you know, what psychologists would call a strong sense of self. You know, it's important to have that. And so to emphasize these teachings too quickly, too much, I think too often does a disservice. And the particular disservice it does is that it sometimes limits people's understanding, valuing of cultivation, of developing themselves in certain ways. And classically in Buddhism, a lot of practice is about cultivating and developing ourselves. And to rush to have insight to seeing before we're properly cultivated and we have some stability is not often so useful. And so as Matthew said last night, there's a difference between the insights that come with practice and the practices we do. We don't practice suffering. We don't practice impermanence. We practice, we do practices that prepare us to be able to encounter the world of change in a way that's liberating from the grip of desire. We cultivate ourselves in such a way that we're prepared to encounter this unsatisfactory nature of our experience, to understand what it means. We prepare ourselves, cultivate, so when the time is ripe, we can experience for ourselves what is meant by this not-self experience or insight. It's not something we have to believe, it's something we prepare ourselves for, so when the time is right, that is revealed. And so the actual practice of Buddhism, of meditation, there's many forms, many purposes, but in terms of these three characteristics, these three insights, we're actually cultivating the opposite. We're cultivating stability or constancy, not impermanence. We're cultivating well-being, not suffering. And we're cultivating confidence. We're not cultivating not-self. And if we cultivate these well, then at some point the insights can happen on their own. We don't have to go searching for them. They'll come to you when things are ripe, when ready. So for this retreat, then, we would like to do is to give three talks on these what we're cultivating stability, cultivating well-being, and cultivating confidence, self-confidence, as a preparation for the last three talks of the retreat, which is to talk about these three insights, the insight into impermanence and constancy, insight into dukkha, and insight into not-self. So today it's stability. And I think that a lot of the beginning of a retreat, the first day of the retreat with all its difficulties, has a lot to do with just arriving and settling in, letting the body relax, some attentions we have to settle away, and kind of giving ourselves the kind of just time to settle. And a lot of that settling is, or at least some of that settling, isn't so much about what we do, but rather the fact that here we're not doing so much. We're not involved in work, we're not involved in a lot of the social relationships we're usually involved in conversations, we're not reading the news, We're not on the TV or the computer. It's relatively simple. And in this simplicity of not so many activity, our system begins to relax and settle and unwind. And sometimes I think the first day, it's mostly about unwinding. You don't really need to try so hard to get concentrated or, you know, be a successful meditator. You just have to stay here and go along and just kind of settle down and let this initial unwinding happen. A big support for this is this simplicity of practice with breathing and simplicity of being in the body. At least I find it tremendously valuable to just be present in my body, to check in with my body, be here. Because the more I can kind of feel and be in my body, the more it seems to settle. The alternative for me, being in the body, is to be in my thoughts, to be in the control tower. And that's where things get spinning and spinning and spinning. The image I have for my little head is that it's a bowl with marbles in it, and the marbles are spinning. And sometimes I'm in there kind of pushing the marbles, giving them momentum. And if I keep spinning the marbles, they'll always spin around that bowl, around and around and around, for years. But if I can finally stop pushing them and getting involved in them, the momentum will go out and they'll settle down. So here is to stop pushing them or encouraging them or getting involved in these thoughts. And more than just not getting involved in them, more than just not getting involved in them, it's also changing the orientation we have about how to be alive. Maybe most of you don't think this way, but rather than having the orientation to see and be in the world, mediate the world through the thoughts and ideas we have, in the first days or two of the retreat, it's often useful to mediate the world through being in our bodies. More and more, just feel what it's like to be in the body, to settle into the body, be present for the body, be with the body breathing. And of course, it's hard to do that for many of us the first day. The mind the momentum for thinking is quite strong. The momentum of emotions that are going on, churning away, are quite strong. And that's well known. But to fight that, to be too involved or to get constantly pulled into that world, to keep spinning it, is also not useful. It's to every time that you can kind of gently, lovingly, step away from being involved in your thoughts, step away from being caught in the churnings of emotions, and just feel it and be with it in the body, is the slowing down or lessening of that spinning. And the lessening can be imperceptible moment by moment, but over the course of a day and over the course of a retreat, a lot of the momentum, the energy behind these kinds of spinning of the marbles begins to quiet down. All for the purpose of being able to see our life from a different angle, different perspective. The Buddha taught his son how to meditate. Not that many people don't realize the Buddha had a son. And at some point, when his son was a young teenager, he taught him how to meditate. There's a particular story of that event. And the first thing he did, like the pre-instructions for meditation, he told his son, make your mind like the earth. Make yourself like the earth. Because the earth, no matter what happens, you know, if all kinds of people spit on the earth or different things, the earth, back then at least, didn't care. It was equanimous and stayed firm and balanced. Make your mind equanimous, and no matter what strange thoughts and difficulties that come up, that you can hold them in this kind of earthiness. It's this kind of like the firmness or stability of the earth itself. And then he went on and said, "Make yourself like water. Just like the great ocean is also not troubled by your spit in it. So don't worry, but make your mind like the ocean, not troubled by the different thoughts that you might have. Make yourself like fire. Fire is not troubled, big fire. Make yourself like the air. Make yourself like the mind, like space." And this is a kind of a hierarchy here. The ancient mythology of Buddhism, the cosmology, is that this world that we live in, I think the Buddhists believed mostly that the world was flat. Until there was sometimes in the 1950s or something, there was somebody went to Tibet, Tibetan teacher went to a conference, and I guess he said something about the world being flat, and someone, no, the world is round. And he said, oh, okay, maybe it's round now, but it was flat in the time of the Buddha. But the way it's flat is it's layers. And the bottom layer is... I think it's earth, and then there's water, and then there's fire, and then there's air, and then there's space. And I kind of like this. We want to have a firm foundation. And then I was correlating this to what's called the four foundations of mindfulness. We make the body like the earth, firm, stable, still. We make the mind like water to be able to handle all the different feelings that come up, pleasant, unpleasant, and just kind of a fluid with it. We flow with it. We're not caught by it or resist it. Like running water, the constant changing. Make the mind like fire for all the different mental states that we have. And here the idea of fire in the mind, the word jhana, concentration, apparently comes from the word to burn. And the best kind of analogy for this burning of the mind that's in a concentrated mind is that of a candle flame that's burning without any wind. So the flame is completely still, but we know it's quite dynamic on the inside. A mind that's concentrated is bright, dynamic, and completely still. It's not dull. It's all these, all our mental faculties are alive and engaged, but in such a way that everything feels completely still. And then the air, the lightness and the non-resistance of the air, to have the mind, the mental processes, the thoughts, the feelings, whatever goes on in the mind, to operate without any resistance, without any wind drag, without holding on to what's going on, without resisting what's going on. And then awakening, like space, just vast openness, no limitation for the heart, the mind. But this whole process is supported by stability. And what I associate most strongly with stability is the body. So to settle down, to find a way to kind of feel the weight of the body, to feel the body against your cushion in your chair, to maybe as you exhale, to soften and relax some of the tensions of your body, and to begin in a kind of loving way or soft way, keeping the body still. Not freezing the body, but it's sitting and meditating and being somewhat still in a poised, relaxed way. And because it's in a stillness of the body is a great support for for helping the mind calm down and settle down. And then within that stillness of the body, to tune into the rhythm of the movements of the body as we breathe. I find it helpful at the end of, with every exhale, so there are times where every exhale I let go of any thoughts that have come up. I have a tremendous capacity to think, like some of you, and get pulled into my thoughts, And if I kind of remember every time I exhale to let go of my thoughts, it goes a lot easier. And then I let go, and as I let go of my thoughts, I let go into the body that's exhaling. And I find this very calming, very centering. To sit and meditate with a feeling of firmness and strength. This Buddhist tradition puts a lot of emphasis on a certain kind of strength, inner strength, cultivating inner strength. And so to take a posture, to take a way of being that within reason, in a way that seems appropriate, to call forth an inner capacity for being here in a strong, steady, full way. Some people have very little experience of calling on their own inner strength and sitting and upright and being there kind of in a strong way. Some people do that very little in their lives. They sit in chairs in ways that are collapsed and they don't hold themselves up well. But to call forth whatever sense of, even if it's very slight, of being kind of strong and stable, dignified, upright, here. Not to override how you are, not to override maybe your feelings and your what's happening, but to put them in a different context, how you are, so that you're not caught so easily in your thoughts or not swept away by your emotions and feelings. Sometimes when many people are agitated, having one person who's still and stable can calm everybody else down. And so we try to do that for ourselves, to sit in such a way that things can quiet down. Part of the function of a retreat like this is to have a calm environment where there's more and more of this settling and calming of the body, of the system, stabilizing here. So one of the reasons we don't have social talking, it's supported by being in the building in a calm way. Walking around maybe calmly and suddenly, but not just calm, but maybe in a dignified way, an upright way. I can't underscore how much this, at least the ancient tradition of Buddhism, emphasized the dignity of the human being. And I say it because there's so much emphasis in modern Buddhism sometimes in this teaching of no self, not self, that it's almost like people get the impression that they shouldn't count. They're supposed to be all about self-effacing and not being anyone. But this ancient tradition, they had this teaching of not self for sure, but the context of it was to be a very dignified, valued person, a worthy person, to show up in a strong way. I know it's easier said than done, but I wonder whether being here on this retreat, whether there isn't something that you can pull forth inside of you that would be supportive for you to settle more. Some kind of strength, some kind of dignity, some kind of appreciation of yourself that allows you to sit here, to be here, to walk here in a kind of clear way that you're really here, you're embodied here, like you're here. And the sense of here-ness, a sense of presence, sense of value, dignity, really you inhabit it. You inhabit your body. You inhabit your posture. An image that I like a lot for the practice of concentration. So, for example, staying with your breathing best you can, one breath after the other, is a boat going through water. Because they have these narrow bows, the boat cuts through the water, and the water just gets pushed along the side of the boat, and there's a wake that forms. But the water doesn't really stop the boat if it has some momentum going. Because everything just falls off the side. So to hold the course of the boat of attention on the breathing, all kinds of things can come up, thoughts and emotions and sensations, all kinds of things can happen. And, unless it's really compelling, maybe you can just, all those things can just be washing off the side of the boat. And you hold the course of the boat on the breath. You don't have to stop in order to review every thought or pick up every sensation and every emotion, but to kind of stay steady, stay a certain kind of firmness and stability. Something that I found fascinating and helpful in my practice is to notice those times where I feel like I'm somewhat present in my body, stable and calm and present. And then when I get pulled into my thoughts, and to see the change, to see how in a certain way I've left my body, I've kind of pulled up. For me, sometimes it's almost like there's a vacuum cleaner kind of thing, that like, and my presence, my sense of being, my attention, my sense of being in a body, just gets and up into the head. Everything goes up there, and I've lost touch with my body. And I, the more juicy, the more powerful the thoughts are, the more like, there I am. And it's fascinating the difference to see, that how much is lost by getting kind of caught up in the world of thoughts, and then find my way back down, settle back down into this body. And I find that I have a very different relationship with my thoughts when I'm settled in my body. I still think, but then the thoughts are more like the water kind of washing off the side of the boat, and I can hold the course. Not so pulled into that world so much. So it's, I haven't had a chance to talk to you about, to know what your first day has been like. Maybe I'll hear a little bit about it when we do the fireside chat. But often the first day is difficult, and people's bodies are often hurt more than they expected. They're more tired than they expected. They didn't expect to have a headache, but they do. Their mind is more unruly than any time they meditate at home. What happened here? All kinds of things. It's going to be quite, it can be difficult the first day. But no amount of mindfulness is ever wasted. And it's part of the process is to work with this. But maybe you don't have to work at it so much. It's mostly coming back, being here, trusting the process, showing up. One of the little practices that have been very important for me when it's been hard to be present is I say the word here, H-E-R-E. Not a command like you would for a dog maybe, but just here. And I say the word here as a reminder, I'm here. And then I take a moment, because that's usually all I get, to just notice what it's like to be here. And the sense of, like, I open my awareness to just open very broad, what is here? Here's a person whose mind is out of control, a lot of thoughts. Here's this, here's feelings. And it's kind of very allowing. And then I get pulled back into what I was thinking. And then I say it again, here. It's like this. Here. Oh, it's like this. And I notice. And I keep doing that. And what happens for me is it takes a while. At some point, that kind of clear, simple recognition, I'm here. And then allowing myself to be here as I am, but to see it for what it is, something begins to quiet down. Something begins to settle. It's almost as if the driving energy of thinking that churns away, that fuels the thinking, operates best if it's not being watched. But if I kind of allow it and see what's going on, it tends to quiet down. And then at some point I stop saying here, I don't need to anymore, and then I'm here and settled. So keep it simple. And I appreciate very much that your practice today. I'm very grateful when people come on retreat, grateful for people who are still here after 12 hours of the first day. It's really worthwhile. You're on a journey, and that journey of the week will unfold in many different ways. If you've come to conclusions already this first day, that you should have gone on vacation instead, or that this is the wrong time of year for a retreat, or you know, you grand, or so some people the conclusion is I need to tell all my friends to come on retreat, you know, whatever conclusions you have come to the first day, just kind of take it in stride. It's just these are first day thoughts. Don't you don't have to buy into them or believe them. These generalizations, these judgments, these conclusions, and you know you're in for a journey, and the journey unfolds and will unfold and open up in different ways. And it's supported by stability, by being settled. By constancy. Constancy in just practicing, the constancy of practice, so that we have the stability to really see the instability of this world. So we have the constancy that allows us and supports us to see the inconstancy of the world, so that we have a settledness that allows us to see how unsettled things really are. And it's a little bit of a paradox, but this means that the inconstancy, the impermanence, the unsettledness of this world is not going to be so oppressive or so difficult because you have the foundation to hold it and be with it. So for this day, and for this beginning of the retreat, you might want to give some thought to what supports you to feel more stable and settled as you're here, and to kind of gravitate towards that settled place. Kind of let that be kind of the, you know, kind of the task these first couple of days. And then tomorrow, Matthew will talk about well-being. And then it'll all be good.